This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Joseph Dobrian. Joseph, great talking to you.
Nice to talk to you also.
You're a writer. You write poetry, plays, and you submit essays and op-eds to your local paper in Iowa City. You're from Iowa, and you've spent a lot of your life in New York City. Can you kind of give us like your brief biographical information?
Yes, I'm a graduate of the University of Iowa, class of 1977. Shortly thereafter, I moved to New York City and lived there for approximately 30 years. Then in 2010, I moved back to Iowa City because New York City just wasn't that much fun anymore. I've been, for the past more than 30 years, more like 35 years, I reckon, I've been making my living as a business journalist. I've been strictly freelance for the past 31 years, and I make a reasonably good living at it. I'm a writer for hire. I'm a hack. I make no bones about that. I'm probably best known in the business community as a financial and real estate journalist. In the artistic community, I'm best known as a novelist. I've had three novels published so far, plus a collection of essays and a translation of a French true crime book. Currently at work on my fourth novel.
And you also ran for mayor of New York City in 2009 against Bloomberg.
That's correct. I was the Libertarian Party's candidate for mayor of New York City, and I came in seventh in a field of eight, which was about what I expected to do because, you know, there are not a lot of libertarians in New York City. Libertarians tend not to live in big cities because they don't like an activistic, service-oriented government.
Were you in the debates? I think the, was that the one where the rent was too damn high candidate was in there?
That's
right.
Jimmy, oh, what's his name? He's got the beard. I forget.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he's sort of a moron. But, yeah, we had a couple of debates featuring the minor candidates. We were not invited to the debates between Bloomberg and his opponent, Mr. Thompson, because they did not want to give us a hearing. You know, they didn't want to provide a podium to these minor candidates. So we, among ourselves, organized debates featuring just the minor candidates. There were a couple of them, and frankly, none of us covered ourselves with glory.
When did you originally move to New York, and what are your thoughts on how the city has changed since you lived there and until the time you left?
Well, when I moved there in the early 1980s, it was still kind of raw, kind of dangerous, and I was just starting out career-wise, so I didn't have a lot of money. I lived in a kind of a nasty ghetto neighborhood, and I lived kind of a rough lifestyle for a while. I was kind of living the guys and dolls lifestyle, you might say, because I had a respectable job, but it largely caused me to spend a lot of time with athletes, gamblers, petty criminals, all that fun stuff. I was a boxing writer at the time. And so, as I say, I was kind of leading the guys and dolls lifestyle, and it was quite fun. It wasn't a fancy lifestyle, but I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the rawness of it, the slight danger and so forth. And over the years, New York City became a little bit too sanitized for me. You know, I got too dignified, too kid-friendly, too no-smoking.
Did that inspire your run for office?
Yes, indeed it did.
And were those some of your platform principles, things like smoking?
Well, what I said basically was that with the city council being what it was highly unlikely that we would get any of the more onerous rules and regulations repealed. So my approach, if I had been elected, would have been to just not spend any time or effort or money on enforcement. Of course, I knew perfectly well that I had no chance whatsoever of winning election. So really, it's academic what I would have done. But that was the line that I gave to the voters.
And then you moved back to Iowa City. Most people are not as familiar with that. How would you describe Iowa City to someone who's never been there?
Well, some people call it Little Berkeley on the Prairie. Some people call it the People's Republic of Iowa City. It's a very, very left-wing university town, and I have a big problem with the politics here. But when I decided to leave New York City, I decided that I wanted a university town with a decent school of music, because I'm very much interested in classical music, and a decent football program, because that's another of my big interests. So I scouted around, examined several options, then I decided that at least Iowa City was a known quantity because I had done my undergrad here and I still knew some people here. So I decided to move back to Iowa City. And since then, I've been developing my reputation as kind of a local crank. And I piss a lot of people off because my politics are unconventional for this town. That is for certain. I belong to the, well, I would call myself a libertarian who caucuses with the Republicans. So I'm on the liberty side of the right wing, you might say. And I get a lot of people angry at me for my positions on various issues, because I go against the prevailing opinion. And, I recently was scheduled to give a reading of my latest novel at the iconic Prairie Lights bookstore, and had that canceled because there were threats of a disturbance if I were to read there. I mean, that's the kind of stuff you have to put up with in this town if you are at all vocal in your political incorrectness. But the football games are a lot of fun, and the School of Music is really good, and the music students all know that overdressed guy who always sits at the front row of just about every recital.
And by overdressed, you actually mean you actually wear and design your own 1930s style suits?
Pretty much. I wouldn't call them really 1930s style, but they're very much influenced by the fashions of the 1930s. And yeah, I wear a suit and a tie every day, and they are mostly suits that I've designed myself. And that makes me look better dressed, because if your suit fits you as though it were made specifically for you, well, it's going to make you look a little more impressive. And I have a talk show on local cable TV as well. And I recently did a show in which I explained how you can dress for success. So that's another way I get my name out there, with this talk show.
And you submitted a lot of op-eds to the Iowa City Press Citizen. Are these op-eds you submit, or are you an official journalist for them?
Well, I have a regular slot once a month, and I usually talk about political issues, although quite often I talk about the arts instead, especially music and writing generally. So I try to go back and forth on alternate months. One month I'll write something very political, and then on another month I might write something that's a little less political and more oriented towards the arts or lifestyle or whatever.
When it comes to arts, and as well as film, architecture, just the arts in general, are you a traditionalist, or do you appreciate a modern art as well?
I am generally a traditionalist, but I don't hate modern art. I realize that if art is to stay alive, if it's not going to stagnate entirely, then there has to be experimentation. There has to be innovation, and it's not always going to work. It's going to have to stand the test of time like any other type of art from any other period. So generally speaking, I'm not crazy about modern art, modern architecture, whatever, but I'm glad to see people experimenting.
And with modern art, there's also What do you think about the distinction between modernism and postmodernism?
I am not well enough educated in that area to know the difference.
It's kind of more like, I'm not a fan of postmodernism. I think we're in a period of post-postmodernism, but I find that postmodernism was an attempt to try to make everyone get into modernism, but hence now in postmodern art we see it from a unmade bed to, piss Christ, you know? This kind of anything can be art right from the urinal, you know?
Yeah. Well, I don't particularly like that kind of art.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that certain types of art, like piss Christ, as you cited, they strike me as more of an effort to offend rather than to create art. But, you know, what do I know? I'm just not a terribly sophisticated person.
Or to deconstruct, as they call it, in their fancy terms. It really is a hostile environment to some, you know?
You have a recent op-ed called Abolish the NEA, the National Endowments for the Arts. I read over that. I have partial agreements and partial disagreements, but I guess first I'll let you make basically your key points of that article, and then I'll mention the points that I agree or disagree.
Okay, well, my chief overriding point is that nobody should be forced to subsidize an expression that they abominate. So if Piss Christ is funded by the NEA against the wishes of a taxpaying citizen who finds that particular type of art abominable, well, then that's a really good argument for abolishing the National Endowment for the Arts. Quite aside from the question of whether art should be government funded at all, I don't think it should be. I think that the government should be as small as possible and should be in charge of funding as few things as possible. I believe government should be responsible for national defense, for law enforcement, and probably for some infrastructure, and very little else besides that. And a lot of people, a lot of libertarians especially, say that taxation is theft, and yes, it probably is. However, I'm a pragmatist. I realize that there has got to be taxation if there's going to be civilization. I don't, though, think that tax dollars should be spent for highly debatable projects such as funding the arts.
So there's two key points to that. There's the issue of the politicization of the National Endowments for the Arts. Were you making the case that there's a lot of affirmative action and political favoritism towards certain groups? With that point, I pretty much agree with you.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned that, by the way. That wasn't a major part of my argument. But yes, it does happen, and I think it's regrettable. I don't think the government should be in the business of picking winners or losers. I don't think the government should be in charge of favoring any race or gender or sexual persuasion or what have you.
And then the other issue is financial support for artists, having artists becoming financially self-sufficient. That's the part where I guess I have a disagreement, because some artists are lucky enough to have financial patrons. But throughout history, I mean, a lot of the greatest artists, like Van Gogh, have pretty much died in poverty. And there's like a small handful of artists who have managed to become very successful. But there's also countless great artists and writers who really can't support themselves on their arts alone. What my basic opinion
true.
Is that is, I think, with the National Endowments of the Art, I think you're absolutely right that there is political angles and favoritisms for certain types of art, but there should be some kind of mechanisms of having artists being able to support themselves through their arts, and then basically not necessarily picking winners and losers, but giving all artists a chance at least to put their art out there and to support themselves. And then from there, the best art will just kind of rise up to the top. But with depending on economic elites, government will favor certain types of arts, but then economic elites will favor certain types of art. But I think the key is just giving artists a chance to become economically self-sufficient. If the private sector can do it, that's great. But if not, then I think the government does have to have a role. Then from there, let the best art like rise to the top.
If the government has a role, that means that they are taking money by force from you and me to give to these artists who apply for grants. They get to choose which artists get the grants. I have no input in that. I just have my money taken away from me by force to pay for whoever the government thinks ought to be paid. That is immoral. That is sinful.
With the argument in general, there is the argument of people having to pay for things they disagree with. Liberals will say that they object to tax dollars going to wars that they see as unjust. Then conservatives will say they don't want their tax dollars going to abortion. But isn't
I agree. That's why government should be small. That's why government should be small and should not be in the business of paying for anything that it doesn't absolutely have to pay for. Yeah, I think liberals and conservatives both have a strong argument on that score.
So with funding of the arts, how do you successfully do it through the private sector and make sure that artists have the opportunity to make a living?
Well, first of all, you find a wealthy patron to subsidize you. If you can't, then maybe that's just because your art isn't that good. Or you get commissions. You get commissions from people who want their portraits painted or from churches that want to have their interiors decorated. Or you get, if you're an architect, you get commissions to build somebody's house or to build somebody's office building. You go out there and you look for work. And it's not always going to be work that you like. For example, I would love it if I were paid to do nothing but write fiction. Unfortunately, that's not on. So I have to make the bulk of my income writing about real estate or the stock markets or what have you. And I figure that is just the price I pay for wanting to be an artist. I should not expect anyone to subsidize me simply because I have a beautiful soul and I have such an artistic personality. No, I have to go out there and earn a living. And sometimes I have to do stuff that I would rather not do.
Well, I'm not a fan of most modern art at all, because as you were saying, it seems to be that there is this, at least far left kind of takeover. You could say most of it is probably liberal propaganda in a way. And
you like these artists that are avant-garde and controversial, like Trevor Brown. I wouldn't necessarily, it's not, his work is not traditional, but
you could say it's decadent. It's not exactly.
I don't know if he's decadent, but he's not accepted by the mainstream liberal art scene either. He's sort of...
Yeah, because at least there's the typical artists that push buttons, but as we were saying, deconstructing is a deliberate attack on a certain value. And then there are artists that want to show new ways, and everyone doesn't get it, or at least that, you know, a certain emotion you want to bring up. That's okay. But yeah, the emotions that people, especially from liberals, are bringing up, like Piss Christ, are basically an attack on, you know, the Christian value. That's not necessary. They want to push, or even, oh, what was that? The Scandinavian artist who made those giant inflatable butt plugs out in the park. Somebody got mad and popped it, you know? It just shows you how way it's going down, this art. And a lot of it we have lost, you know, aesthetically pleasing art. I always liked aesthetically. I loved cartoons, and I love cartoons because it's a very simplistic ideal of art. But people are so obsessed with the message in there, and I don't know where the fine arts is even going, or at least there's a bunch of bored rich people that'll just buy Damien Hirst over and over again.
Right. You know, I'm pretty liberal about what people ought to produce artistically. If you want to do a Piss Christ or an inflated butt plug or something like that, that's fine. That's your right. But the government shouldn't pay for it. Who should pay for it would be somebody who wants a piece, a representation of an inflated butt plug or somebody who will pay for an offensive statue or a pornographic painting or whatever, that's fine. They have every right to pay for it, and you have every right to produce it. You also have the right to produce it and just hope that somebody will buy it. That's what I do with my novels. I certainly don't collect big advances for them. I pretty much depend on people buying them on a per copy basis. So I'm never going to get rich as a novelist. I use my other type of writing, my commercial writing, in order to subsidize my creative writing. And that's what a lot of artists should do. And as a matter of fact, they are usually made better artists by that experience.
With your fiction writing, you have a lot of strong political views, but you prefer to write fiction novels that touch on cultural and political themes than to write nonfiction political novels.
That's right. I enjoy telling stories. And my novels usually do have a political element, and certainly my political views do inform my fiction. But generally speaking, my objective is just to tell an interesting story rather than to convince anybody of my political positions. Now, my first novel, which is called Willie Wilden, was very political. It had to do with the protagonist was a conservative, traditional college professor at a very liberal, progressive college, and he was fighting the evil forces of political correctness. And it was basically social satire, and very, very political in nature. Clearly, the novel had a political message, although I tried to be lighthearted about it. But then my other novels, well, the next novel was called Ambitions, and it was a novel primarily to do with a rather dysfunctional family and the various adventures of the people in that family. And that was more, just a soap opera, really. It was about these people just trying to get through life as best they could, and there was very little politics involved. And then my third novel was called Hardwired, and that sort of struck a middle ground. That's a coming-of-age novel about a teenage boy growing up in the 1960s in a small Midwestern town, and it's mostly just about, you know, how an insecure teenage boy gets through those very difficult years. But, of course, there was a little bit of politics involved. He was growing up in the mid-1960s. He was aware of John F. Kennedy and Barry Goldwater and Lyndon Johnson, and he paid attention to current events and commented on them. But it wasn't really a political book. It was more of a philosophical book.
So in the book, he creates alternative realities in which he's powerful, accomplished, brave, and sometimes vengeful. Who is so... He feels a lot of strong sense of alienation. Is it just a sort of general resentment against society?
Well, not really resentment against society so much as, he's a very awkward and unpopular kid, and he's aware of this, of course, but he largely blames himself for it. He knows that he's socially awkward and unattractive, so he accepts a lot of the blame for it. But he also watches society evolve around him and realizes that there are just too many people out there who are too interested in minding other people's business. And he resents that, and he becomes more and more politicized as the book moves along. And then at the end of the book, he gets involved in a bit of school politics in which he... puts himself at risk somewhat, because over the years he has gradually managed to make himself one of the cool kids, and now he's involved in a political situation at his school that might threaten his social status. So that's sort of the crisis of the book, you might say.
And he's also been described as a modern Don Quixote in the review.
Well, that's what the character is described as, yes. He reads the novel Don Quixote, and he's impressed by it, and sort of sees himself in that way. Because of course Don Quixote was really comprehensively delusional. He was crazy. Now, the protagonist of this book, his name is Andy Palinkas. Andy realizes that he is perfectly sane, but he does have a way of engaging himself in lost causes, much as Don Quixote used to do. So he sort of sees himself as a would-be knight in shining armor who is painfully aware that he's really pretty much just a poor schlub.
Is that a critique of a lot of political dissidents? They go on these crusades, but then it ends up not going anywhere, and they feel hopeless in their political objectives.
Well, you know, I haven't thought of that. That wasn't in my mind when I wrote the book, but of course anybody who reads the book is welcome to, you know, take what they can from it. And so, yeah, now that you mention it, it wouldn't be too far-fetched to think that some reader would take that message from it. But as I say, that wasn't my intention.
Which writers have had the greatest impact on you?
Okay, that's a good one. I would say that probably the most impactful novel I've ever read was Vanity Fair by William Makepeace Thackeray, which was written about the middle of the 19th century. And it's a big, sprawling novel with lots of characters in it. And the main character is a young woman named Becky Sharp, who is a psychopath. She's just a really, really evil person. And the novel is largely about her adventures and misadventures. And there are a lot of subplots, a lot of intricate subplots. And it's a very philosophical book as well. And that, I think, was maybe the single novel that has influenced me the most over the years. Another author who has influenced me very much is Herman Wolk. He is an American Jewish author who flourished mostly in the middle and late 20th century. Still alive. He's over 100 years old and still alive. And he was a rather clunky and clumsy writer. He was not a stylist. He wrote these big, long books about people's passage through life, you might say. Books like The Caine Mutiny and Marjorie Morningstar and Youngblood Hawk and so on. And I think his novel, The Caine Mutiny, is one of the most important novels of the 20th century. It's about a young naval officer in World War II. And it shows his passage from when he's just starting out in the Navy and he's a spoiled rich kid and not particularly good at what he does. But then over time, he goes through the fire and ends up really quite an outstanding naval officer. And that is a book that teaches you a lot about just how to grow up, how to make a man of yourself. So I found that one very important also. I also went through a phase where I was very much enjoying the works of Robert Coover, who is a pretty experimental novelist, and I haven't liked everything he's written, but I do appreciate the fact that he takes chances, that he experiments. So, yeah, as you go through life, you'll come up with a lot of different literary influences. I'm also much influenced by journalists rather than novelists. A.J. Liebling, for example, and George Orwell wrote terrific journalism, and I feel I've been able to draw on their techniques in my fiction.
You said you also have an upcoming novel coming out. Do you want to disclose the theme of that, or would you rather keep it a surprise?
I'd rather not talk about it at this point because it's still close to 2 years from publication, and I'm still finishing up the first draft, and of course there's an awful lot of changes that take place between the first draft and the last, so I'd really rather not talk about it too much. Let's just say that it has a lot to do with football.
You know, when I my favorite book that still has influenced me to this day is a science fiction novel by Brian Aldiss, and it's called Nonstop. And it's a very simplistic science fiction novel, basically about generational ship in space, but it's a jungle planet. And it's a very strange book because, one, of its age, and two, it's very surreal or contradictory of reality is how you read the narrative of the book. I won't give any spoilers, but Brian Aldiss is a pretty well-known English science fiction writer, and he has definitely influenced the way I think about things and how I personally write. But since then, I've been a huge fan of science fiction, and I love like Isaac Asimov and other English writers like E.C. Tubb.
Is science fiction what you mostly write?
Yes, I've been trying to write science fiction, but it led more into, I guess, pulp romance at the current moment, or at least strange stuff. But I'm trying to find a voice. I still have to practice writing, so.
That's great.
What are your general thoughts on censorship and how that relates to the arts in regards to especially writers, visual artists? You said you had an issue with that with one of your book readings.
Yeah, that's what I call the heckler's veto, when you're not allowed to say or publish something because people just shout you down. I'm not crazy about that. I think it's disgusting when people try and prevent people from expressing themselves. Now, if I write a book that nobody wants to buy because it's crap, well, then that's my problem. But if I publish a book and people try to suppress publication because they don't like what's in it, then that's another matter. Whether the government does it or whether a mob does it, that's not on. I say that artistic expression should be allowed to stand or fall on its merits, and not just artistic expression, pretty much any expression.
What was the primary reason that your speaking event was shut down by the hecklers?
Well, first of all, I think it was because I had written an op-ed piece about a year and a half ago. Well, now it's been 2 years, more than 2 years, but at that time it was about a year and a half ago. I had written an op-ed piece in which I said that feminism does not empower women. Feminism infantilizes women. And that's just something that Camille Paglia and others have been saying for a long time. But I guess the local left-wingers in this town had never heard it before. So, oh my gosh, there was all kinds of outcry about it when that article came out. And then when it came time for me to read this book in public, which had nothing to do with that article, by the way, people decided that I was not going to be allowed to read because I was such a horrible person. I imagine that it also had to do with the fact that this incident took place right after the presidential election. And so people were, rending their garments and wearing their bloody diaper pins and so on. And it was well known that I had been an opponent of Hillary Clinton, that I had campaigned against her. And so, of course, I suppose they felt they ought to take it out on me because Hillary hadn't been elected. So it was a combination of things. But basically, I'm politically incorrect in this town, and some people felt that it would be proper to shut me down.
I did read the article. You did reference it was in response to like a Facebook meme that you came across.
That's right. Yeah, I referenced a Facebook meme in which it was a picture of a woman who had obviously been ejaculated on by a whole bunch of guys. And the caption said, "Feminism, because cleaning the house is too demeaning," or something like that.
Oh, I remember that porn star. I think it was Bell Knox, who did a lot of really disgusting stuff, and then she said it was like trying to make a political statement that was empowering.
Or what about that one famous porn actress? I can't recall her name. She did the world's biggest gangbang or something. You don't hear about her much her anymore, but like over 100 men.
I don't
men.
Know her name. There's just been countless people, like the biggest this, the biggest that.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, it's a very strange and weird and disturbing. You don't know. It's like when Femin goes and they use their menstrual blood to make a protest. I'm like, is this really what empowered women do, or is this just a weird
Well, that
thing?
Was exactly that was exactly the point I was making in this article, that this was not empowering. This is women making fools of themselves, demeaning themselves deliberately, and I said it does not empower women. It turns otherwise strong and capable women into nasty, potty-mouthed little girls.
Mm. What are your general thoughts on the whole kind of alt-right phenomenon?
I am suspicious of the alt-right because it does not strike me as libertarian. It strikes me, in some cases, as kind of neo-Nazi. It is too closely aligned with white nationalism, which I think is a bag of bullshit, if you'll pardon my French. So I would not consider myself alt-right. I would say that I roughly agree with the alt-right on a few points, but
primarily
I wouldn't...
the issue of about political correctness.
Yeah, yeah, and I appreciate anybody who stands up to the Antifa, who are really they are the Sturmabteilung of our generation, except that they're physical cowards.
Someone described you as if you're writing, if compared to visual art, someone made the comparison to the artist Aguirre.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true. And I was very flattered by the comparison because Goya tended to paint people rather grotesquely, you know, warts and all. And he used color very cleverly. And he brought a sort of a satirical eye to his paintings. So, yeah, I was very flattered to be compared with Goya.
Do you remember who that was and what the specific context was?
Yes, I believe that was a children's author named Lynn Biederman, who wrote a blurb for my first novel, Willie Wilden. Lynn Biederman is another author who might be worth looking into if you have a young adult at home, somebody who reads young adult fiction, then you might want to look up the name of Lynn Biederman and buy one or two of her novels.
Overall, who are some of your favorite visual artists? Would you say Goya is one of them? And who else are some of your top artists?
Actually, Goya is not one of my favorites of all time. I mean, he's good. I like his stuff, but he's not the guy that I really seek out and look at a coffee table book of his paintings. No. The ones that I really admire, well, Walter Sickert is one that I like very much. He was a British artist who flourished in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. There were rumors that he was Jack the Ripper. I don't believe he actually was Jack the Ripper, but there were those rumors. Anyway, Sickert did some really interesting stuff. A lot of it was kind of stark, disturbing. Edward Hopper is another favorite of mine, although I've been told by people who know their stuff that I ought not to like Edward Hopper, but what can I tell you? I like him. Gilbert Stuart is from 200-300 years ago. He's another favorite of mine. And, gosh, who else? It's quite a few that I like.
Do you have favorite architectural styles?
Favorite architectural styles? Well, I'm all over the joint there. I do like some modern stuff. I like the Federalist style of around the late 1790s, early 1800s.
So that's basically Washington, D.C., the White House.
Right. Right. I like that sort of stuff. I also have a perverse fondness for the work of these mega architects like Albert Speer and Hugh Ferris, people who did these really enormous, dramatic, over-the-top buildings. That's quite fun.
Do you like the Art Deco skyscrapers in New York, like the Chrysler Building and Empire State Building?
Oh, sure.
On New York, I was reading I don't know if this is just some kind of a fantasy, a conceptual project, but there's been talk of rebuilding the original Penn Station as a replica. They're always putting those ideas out there.
It sounds like a fun idea. Penn Station as it stands now is not particularly attractive.
This issue kind of does tie in with the whole libertarian debate, but what do you think about historic preservation laws and the issue of property rights? Do you think there should be a government intervention to protect historic landmarks?
Well, you know, intellectually, I don't think there should be, but that is not an issue that I'm going to get too terribly upset about. I mean, yeah, if I stop to think about it, I think it's a bad thing because it interferes with the right to property. And I think there should be very, very few, if any, restrictions on the right to property. So, yeah, intellectually it bothers me, but I can understand the reasoning behind it. And so I'm not usually going to get too terribly upset about a building being preserved for historic reasons. Call me a hypocrite if you will, but that's the way it goes. You gotta pick your battles. You know, you can't get indignant about everything.
I think with libertarians, there's like the ideological purist libertarians. Then there's people who are maybe libertarian. They lean libertarian. It's like small L libertarianism. Or you have conservative-leaning libertarians, or even like left-leaning libertarians. Like, I don't think if you're part of an ideology, you have to subscribe to it like it's a religion.
Yeah. Well, you know, in my heart, I'm a wild-eyed radical libertarian, but in my head, I'm more of a pragmatist. I realize that you have to have some government, that you're never, in our lifetimes anyway, never going to achieve a true libertarian society. That would be the work of centuries.
On architecture, I'm looking at some pictures of Iowa City. I really like the Englert Theater. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's nice. The Englert Theater is it's a movie theater. It's, I believe, the oldest movie theater in town. And all of the downtown movie theaters were closing because in a town like Iowa City, if you want to see a movie, you go to a mall. You don't go downtown anymore. That's a thing of the past. Well, the Englert was a rather old and very grand theater. And it had been used not just for movies, but for theatrical events and so on. And so a bunch of people in this town decided to get together and fund the preservation of the Englert Theater. And they were successful. It stands to this day. It hosts a lot of cultural events. It's a really nice thing. And it was done mostly by private funding. I don't know the details. I don't know to what extent, if any, the government was involved, but I do know that it was largely privately funded.
So, yeah, I'm looking at the information. It was built in 1912. It was originally a vaudeville-era playhouse, renovated in 2004. The marquee on it looks like it may have been built, I'm guessing, maybe the 40s or 50s, maybe the 1940s.
Probably so, yes. We do have some nice architecture in this town. Some of it is old, and some of it is quite new. For example, we have the Church of St. Mary of the Visitation, which is the oldest Catholic church in town. It's a splendid building. It's as opulent as a church can be without being a cathedral. So that's nice. The old Capitol building, Iowa City used to be the capital of Iowa back when Iowa was a territory. But then when it became a state, the capital was moved to Des Moines. However, the territorial capital building still stands, and it's the centerpiece of the University of Iowa campus. And that is a building that looks something like the United States Capitol. It has a big gold dome, and it's really a very imposing building, and everybody in town loves it. So those are a couple of old classics. And then just this past year, we opened a new auditorium and entertainment center, Hancher Auditorium, and that is a very modern piece of architecture and also very impressive, impressive inside as well. We have a new music building at the University of Iowa campus that's also very impressive. So we have a nice mix of old and new architecture in this town. It's a good-looking town, even if you don't like the politics.
Is it a pretty walkable city and pedestrian-friendly?
It is, yes, except that it's very hilly. Now, Manhattan, for example, I used to walk all the time in Manhattan because Manhattan is flat as a pancake. It's a really, really pedestrian-friendly town. Iowa City, they encourage you to walk, but frankly, it's kind of a pain because it's so hilly here, and it's really quite a workout if you're going to take a long walk around here.
Well, by Midwestern standards, it's not like San Francisco or parts of L.A.
I wouldn't say quite as bad as that, no. But a lot of people have a misconception about Iowa. They think Iowa is flat. No, it's not. Western Iowa is rather flat. Nebraska and Kansas are flat. And then you go to the east. Yeah, Illinois is flat as a pancake, so is Indiana. But Iowa mostly is rolling hills.
Is it mostly, is it prairie, or is there a lot of forest?
No, it used to be almost all forest, but then the farmers came in the 19th century and cleared a lot of it. So we have a lot of farmland. We don't have much prairie except in the western part of the state. It's all, most of the state is very, very green, very fertile farmland. This is an agricultural state. Farming has always been our number one industry. And lately, education and insurance are major industries as well. The trucking industry is also very big here.
As far as a film goes, do you have any top filmmakers that you're the most fascinated with?
Not really. I mean, I'm not a big movie person. I go to maybe one or two movies a year. So I'm not really familiar with who the best directors are. I used to admire Woody Allen, but of course sometimes he would produce some absolute crap. Spielberg also, I very much admire his work. Robert Altman did some great stuff, but I'm not really a big expert on movies.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, Joseph, do you have anything else you'd like to add about your background or any of your upcoming projects? Or if people want to check out your TV show?
Okay, well, if you want to check out my TV show, just go on YouTube and Google my name, Joseph Dobrian, D-O-B-R-I-A-N. And you'll find quite a few episodes of my talk show there. And if you want to buy my books, probably not very many bookstores carry them because my publisher is a small imprint that doesn't have a lot of marketing clout. So you're not likely to find them in very many bookstores, but you can certainly get them on Amazon.com. You can go to my publisher. My publisher is called Rex Imperator, and their website is www.rex-imperator.com. Or you can go to my personal website, which is josephdobrian, all one word, .com, and you can order my books from any of those places.
In your TV show, you do have some political talk as well. You mentioned Dressing for Success. You also interviewed Thomas Sowell. That was uploaded in January.
Yeah, that I didn't interview Thomas Sowell. That was just me reading from some of his work. But my talk show is mostly about musical and artistic and academic issues. I interview a lot of musicians. I interview college professors and artists of various types. So I do have some politics on my talk show, but I generally try to stick more with the arts and with academia.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Joseph Dobrian for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Thank you very much for asking me. I really appreciate it.
And also, thanks, Pilliter.
It's nice talking to you guys, like always.
Yeah, thanks, you guys.